As jail populations decreased last year due to COVID-19, the number of deaths in Oregon jails increased. Disability Rights Oregon, Oregon's leading statewide disability rights organization, revealed that most of the people who died in Oregon jails in 2020 had a disability. Liz Reitz is a public interest law fellow with Disability Rights Oregon. She just released her new report, Grave Consequences: How the Criminalization of Disability Leads to Deaths in Jail. Liz Reitz, your report claims that 9 of the 10 people who died in Oregon jails last year had a disability. Were any of these deaths due to COVID-19?
So the COVID-19 pandemic is raging through Oregon's prisons, but as of the time of our investigation, had not started going through the jails yet. None of these deaths were due to COVID-19. That's one of the things that was so troubling about this number, is that in a year when the COVID-19 pandemic is raging through many institutional populations, we still saw an increase in the number of people who died in jails, despite a lower population overall.
You mentioned two people in your report, Alex Jimenez and Jennifer McLaren. These people were not hardened criminals who committed heinous crimes. So why were they arrested and how did they die?
Yeah, so I'll start with Alex Jimenez. He was a 34-year-old U.S. Army veteran. He had a mental health condition and he had a history of being houseless. Last April, he was arrested for walking down the middle of the street in Warrenton, Oregon. When police approached him and he didn't respond, they tased him and arrested him. At the jail, several deputies pushed him to the ground and held him down, face down on the concrete. He, after several minutes of being held face down, stopped moving, stopped breathing, and never regained consciousness. He died a few hours later in a hospital. And the second case is Jennifer McLaren. She was a 26-year-old woman being held at the Norcor Jail in the Dalles. When she arrived, she was booked on a probation violation, meaning that she had a prior criminal conviction, was on probation, and violated one of the terms of her probation. When she arrived at jail, she complained of rib pain, and she actually had a cellmate who was concerned about her health and said she didn't want to be in the same cell as Jennifer because she didn't want to catch whatever Jennifer had. It turned out Jennifer had pneumonia. She asked to be taken to a hospital to receive treatment for her condition. Her requests were denied time and time again. She did not receive direct medical care until the last 24 hours of her life. And by then it was too late. Jennifer never made it to a hospital and she died in Norcor of pneumonia, which is an extremely treatable condition.
Liz, you mentioned the use of restraints in the death of Alex Jimenez. What behaviors related to a person's disability can be exacerbated by using restraints?
So the use of restraint for people with disabilities is a really troubled topic. In psychiatric settings, in hospital settings, use of restraint is very closely regulated and monitored. In the jail context, in the police context, there just is not the same kind of oversight in the use of restraints. And so holding someone down, jumping to restraint, is not an early intervention. It should come after attempts at de-escalation, attempts to use other kinds of interventions to get someone under control. And what's so troubling about the Alex Jimenez case is that he was in the backseat of the car, and within that, the jail sallyport, the entrance to the jail, there were no evident attempts at de-escalation. Instead, it went straight to, how do we restrain this person?
Now, Disability Rights Oregon has the authority to review jail records because it is the federally designated protection and advocacy system for the state. So how do these deaths in the Oregon jails compare nationally?
Nationally, there's an enormous problem with people dying in jail. So Reuters released a report last October that documented almost exactly the same things we document in our report. It looks like more and more people are dying in jails at a national level. There isn't good oversight for jails, and jails in particular lack oversight. And there isn't a good sense of what what adequate healthcare looks like within a jail context. So the issues that plague Oregon jails, inadequate healthcare, lack of oversight, lack of community support for people with disabilities or people just in need of care in the community, are all driving not only criminalization, but also a population being held in our jails that have an incredibly high level of medical and mental health care needs.
And your report says that 6 of the 10 people who died in Oregon jails last year committed suicide. They died by hanging. Yet none of the 6 people who committed suicide were on suicide watch in the jails.
We have complicated feelings about suicide and suicide protocols. On the one hand, we know that in jails, suicide protocols are often extremely punitive. So people are put into what are called suicide smocks, which are frankly very humiliating and uncomfortable pieces of clothing. They're isolated from the rest of the population within the jail. They don't get access to the same kinds of personal property, connection to people on the outside. And those conditions are the worst possible thing you can do for someone who is in the midst of a mental health crisis. To isolate someone and to take away exactly the things that they need to feel well exacerbates this problem. And so on the one hand, it makes a lot of sense that people who are feeling suicidal don't report that to jail commanders, don't report that to deputies, because they don't want to be put in the suicide protocols. They don't want to be on suicide watch because it's so terrible to be on suicide watch. And what that really speaks to is a need to change our suicide protocols so that they are more therapeutic, so that they align with clinical standards, and so that people who are experiencing suicidal thoughts in jail don't have to fear, don't have to make this choice between, do I get help in quotation marks, which really looks more like punishment, or do I just try to tough it out in the general population?
And there's a huge stigma in the jails for people who are on suicide watch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there are sort of cascading problems and consequences associated with being on suicide watch.
So what are the jail procedures concerning monitoring people in jail?
By Oregon law, jails are required to do hourly welfare checks, which means that they have to look into a cell, confirm someone is alive, breathing, looking okay. That's under normal conditions. In the general population, that's required. If someone's on suicide watch, one of the protocols in place are for more frequent checks. So in a lot of places, that means someone on suicide watch will be getting 15-minute checks. So they'll be getting very consistent checks. And in other facilities, people who are on suicide watch are on what's effectively a 24-hour watch. So their cell is located in a place where there's almost always a deputy with the eyes on them. But one of the troubling findings in this report is that in a couple of cases, we found that though there were documented checks, so in the documentation we received from the jail, it said, we checked these cells. We found that there was evidence that those checks either didn't occur or were not nearly thorough enough. So in one case, someone died in their cell and was not found until rigor mortis had set in. For context, rigor mortis takes generally 2 to 4 hours to set in after someone has died, meaning that this person laid in their cell dead for 2 to 4 hours before being identified by a jail deputy conducting an hourly welfare check. And in another case, someone left the bunk in the night, went to the shower, committed suicide, and was not found until the following morning. So in both of these cases, it again looked like the checks occurred, but the checks were not thorough enough to identify a dead body and a missing person.
And Liz, your report says that our local hospitals are contributing to people ending up dead in Oregon jails.
That's right. So DRO has documented the unfortunate relationship between hospitals and criminalization of mental health conditions. And in this report, we look specifically at hospitals clearing people for jail basically giving a sign off and saying this person can be sent to jail without any restrictions, despite evidence that they probably should have stayed in the hospital. So one of those cases was Alex Jimenez, who we highlighted in the report. He was tased and then brought to a hospital because he was in an apparent psychiatric crisis. He'd just been tased. There were multiple factors at play that made it seem like he was likely not well enough to be in jail. Yet a hospital worker, a doctor, saw him in the back of a police car. Alex Jimenez was, he was moving around in the back of the police car, upset that he had been arrested. He had a very deep fear of the police, a deep fear of being incarcerated. The doctor saw him moving around in the back of the car, gave him a very cursory inspection, said, I guess you're ready to go to jail, and released him to be brought to jail, where he very quickly died. He was held down. He was not well. He never should have been in that jail, Sally Port, to begin with.
And what are the policies of Oregon jails concerning administering medications, especially for people diagnosed with mental illness?
There's a lot of difficulty in our jails around getting people access to needed medications. In some jails, there are no psychiatric prescribers, not just in the jail, but there are no psychiatric prescribers in the city or sometimes even in the county. So people who are brought into jail and really are in dire need of medication don't have access to someone who can get them the prescription that they need. In other cases, people do come in and already have a prescription from care that they were receiving within the community. And in our monitoring work, it's not really covered in this report, but in our monitoring work, we do find that sometimes there's very real difficulties getting the prescription to the right pharmacy, getting a copy of the prescription that the pharmacy will accept. And so people often do have trouble getting access to their medication, and gaps in medication for people with mental health conditions who are receiving medication can be extremely dangerous.
And your report says, Liz, that jail medical staff don't respond to requests for medical care because they believe the person is faking their symptoms or they just want drugs.
So Jennifer McLaren's story is exactly one of those kinds of tragic situations where someone was sick, really desperately needed medical care, but because the jail deputies believed that she was faking, believed that she was drug seeking, they couldn't appropriately understand her medical condition. They made assumptions about her based on who she was, who they understood her to be, and that prevented her from getting the care that she needed. And this really gets at the struggle of jail medical staff to have pressure from multiple ends. Do they identify with their patient, with the person that they're trying to care for? Do they identify with the security staff in the jail where they work? And how do they walk that line? How do they provide excellent care as a medical provider who's also working in this really punitive setting and working within a setting where they have the pressure on the other side to disbelieve someone, to believe that they're asking for something, that they're asking for drugs, that they're just trying to get out of something, right? That's a problem. That's a real pressure that those medical providers are facing. And it created some very, very troubling stories that I had to review for this report.
Your report does mention the need for medical and mental health staff in the jails. We should mention also, Liz, that these deaths in the jails, they do affect the jail staff who end up seeking counseling for themselves.
Absolutely. So none of this is to say that there's a lack of compassion or humanity among many, many members of jail staff, because there is. Speaking with Sheriff Matt Phillips from Clatsop County, where Alex Jimenez died, his staff was extremely troubled by what happened with Alex Jimenez and did seek counseling following that incident. Even after Jennifer McLaren, a different jail, a different part of the state, but even after Jennifer McLaren died of pneumonia, had an autopsy that said she died of pneumonia, someone in the jail continued to say that there was no way she had died of pneumonia, that this must have been from something else. You know, there are so, so many people who want to do right by the people within their care. It doesn't fix the problem of there also being people who, frankly, who can't provide that same kind of care, who their actions make it difficult to understand, especially from an outside perspective. Why did they lack the compassion in that moment? Why couldn't they see people as human?
You reviewed Oregon laws pertaining to medical care in the jails. So what did you find?
What laws? Basically, there's one law that says jails shall create healthcare standards for emergency medical care. And that is the entirety of Oregon law's direction for what medical care should look like in jails. Of course, we also have constitutional requirements to provide adequate health care. But having a constitutional requirement to provide adequate health care doesn't fill in what adequate health care actually is. So that's a big call in this report. We need, as a state, to define what it looks like to give people the health care they are entitled to within jails, to keep them safe, and to prevent these kinds of unnecessary deaths.
And you also found that there are no statutory requirements that jails track or report in-custody deaths.
Right. At the national level, we have the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which jails have the option. They are asked to report in-custody deaths, but often that information basically goes into a black hole. Bureau of Justice Statistics doesn't release individual jail by jail information, and mostly will just aggregate it and every few years produce a report. This isn't to say the work that the Bureau of Justice Statistics does isn't important. It is, but it's not adequate for Oregon. It's not oversight. It doesn't give our state the information it needs to be able to prevent deaths in custody. There's nothing in Oregon requiring that jails share that information. And it is so important that we start actually tracking it so that we can figure out what are the problems and what are the solutions.
And the Oregon State Sheriff's Association conducts inspections in the jails. So does this mean that the sheriffs are monitoring the sheriffs? And even this is only voluntary, and the results are not made public. So of what use are these inspections?
The Oregon State Sheriff's Association inspections have a purpose. They're helpful in terms of giving that body the information they need to be able to share best practices across jails. However, it doesn't really get at the need for oversight. Like you said, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association is, those inspection teams are composed of other sheriffs. A great option for, again, sharing best practices, creating a community among sheriffs. Not so good for informing state policy around what needs to happen within our jails to keep people safe. And there's not teeth to it. If a jail is not doing what the Oregon State Sheriff's Association requests of them, there's no consequence. There's nothing that says, and so you lose licensure, you can no longer book people in your jail. There's no, now you have to pay a fine. It's voluntary.
So Liz, what is Disability Rights Oregon recommending?
So I think first I want to talk a little bit about how we got here. This investigation has roots in not only DRO's ongoing monitoring of jails and prisons, but also in 2019, Oregon Public Broadcasting released Booked and Buried, this really incredible investigative report that found a lot of the same things we found. There's not clear information about what's going on in jails, but it does look like, based on the information we do have, a lot of people are dying, and it seems to be increasing. On the tail of that, the Oregon legislature passed a bill that convened a committee in the Criminal Justice Commission to look at what's going on in jails, basically to start to answer some of these questions that OPB posed. And they found a lot of really good information. Unfortunately, there was still a gap. They still don't know why so many people are dying. And they found the same struggle with getting access to good information about people dying in jails, which is where we came in. The Criminal Justice Commission's recommendations are incredibly important. DRO helped to craft those recommendations, and our report fully endorses them. But we decided to really home in on a few additional points, or to really build on the CJC's recommendations with a few additional points. So the first one is, it is so important that we have good jail oversight. We need an inspection process that is independent of the sheriffs, and we need a transparent system for tracking data about deaths and healthcare in Oregon jails, and make sure that data is publicly available. Oversight has to have both enforcement and transparency. The second thing is, we need adequate healthcare standards and effective suicide protocols in our jails. Like I said earlier, there's no guidance for jails about what adequate healthcare looks like. And that is unacceptable. We have to know what kind of staffing should be required. How can people get access to medication? When do people get sent to the hospital? How do we make sure that when someone leaves a jail and goes back into the community, they're getting a continuity of care? We have to answer those questions as a state. And we have to revise our protocols for suicide. It is unacceptable for people to not try to get help when they're feeling suicidal, because they know that if they ask for help, they'll be punished instead. And the final part is zooming out and really thinking about this at a systems level. We need community support systems for people with disabilities so that they're getting healthcare, social services, housing, treatment in the community, rather than getting stuck in a horrible cycle of getting sent to jail, getting put out on probation, having a probation violation, going back into jail, and they're just on a merry-go-round. They can't get off. So we have to prevent the criminalization and improper incarceration of people with disabilities by investing in our community.
And Liz, are there any bills introduced in this year's legislature?
We're working with legislators to produce bills that start to address some of these recommendations. And so keep a lookout for something related to healthcare standards in jails. I'm really excited about the work that we're starting there. We're going to continue to collaborate with the Oregon State Sheriff's Association to see what kinds of policies we can not only bring to the legislature, but also start to enact through the OSSA to start to get the ball rolling early.
Which legislators are you working with?
Yeah, so far we've been working with Representative Marsh on a legislative concept around jail healthcare standards that is, you know, I'm looking in my email, hopefully coming into its final stages, but hard to say.
The report is Grave Consequences: How the Criminalization of Disability Leads to Deaths in Jail. Liz, where can people find your report?
People can find our report on our website, droregon.org, and it'll be posted not only on the front page, but also in our Mental Health Rights Project section.
I've been speaking with Liz Reitz, a public interest law fellow with Disability Rights Oregon. For KBOO News, I'm Karen James.